First case today is United States v. Tovar Chavez. Is the appellant ready to argue? The government? Appellant may argue.
Chief Judge Suki, members of the court, may it please the court. I am Captain Augustus Turner, and along with co-counsel Lieutenant Colonel Christopher Carrier, we are proud to represent the appellant in this case, Specialist Juvenito Tovar Chavez. Appellant requests 5 minutes for rebuttal, Your Honor.
Yes.
Thank you. Appellant asks this court to continue to apply the longstanding test for constitutional error established by the Supreme Court. In the plain error test, when the substantial right is constitutional, the prejudice is material unless it is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. The Supreme Court established that standard for all courts in Chapman v. California.
Did they establish that for their plain error court, cases?
They did not expressly say the words plain error, Your Honor. In Chapman, the errors at issue were an improper argument and an instruction.
Right, but the Supreme Court has a specific rule on plain error, or the federal courts have a specific rule on plain error. Isn't it Rule 52B?
Yes, Your Honor.
And hasn't the Supreme Court and its federal courts subordinate to it talked extensively about the plain error rule?
Yes, Your Honor.
Have they made a distinction between constitutional and non-constitutional errors in the plain error context?
I believe they have, Your Honor.
They have? Where? I mean, if you're not sure, that's okay. I mean, not trying to put you on the spot. It's just that I'm interested in how they address plain error. As far as I know, they address it quite differently than the military courts. Would you at least agree with that?
Yes, Your Honor, yes.
All right.
But in Chapman, in just like this case, an appellate court applied a statutory standard to test for constitutional error of an instruction based on an instruction. In reversing, the Supreme Court refused to allow a state or federal statute to change the Supreme Court's test for constitutional error. To ensure a universal standard was employed by all courts in future cases, the Supreme Court held that the question was always whether there is a reasonable possibility the evidence complained of might have contributed to the conviction.
Let me ask you this then.
Yes, sir.
Even if there might be some lack of clarity on whether or not the Supreme Court applies the constitutional error standard to plain error, would you at least agree that our plain error standard kind of stems from, at least the one we're presently using, supposedly, stems from a case called United States versus Powell? Are you familiar with United States versus Powell?
Yes, Your Honor, and it is just as recently as this past year in U.S. v. Jones, this court reiterated for the third prong of plain error, when a constitutional issue is reviewed for plain error, the prejudice analysis considers whether the error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt.
Right. But, I mean, one of the problems I think the CCA raised, I think rightly so, that there has been some confusion in our case law, has there not, about what standard to use and who's got the burden and all of that?
We do not see any confusion.
I bet you don't. Well, let me ask you this, then. Do you accept the plain error standard announced in United States versus Powell, and I think carried on through United States versus Caldwell and some other cases? And that is this notion that you find that the defense has the burden to show that they're there, to show that it's plain and obvious, and to show that there has been material prejudice to substantial rights. Isn't that part of the test for plain error that we use around here?
Yes, Your Honor.
Now, in Powell, well, I mean, you seem to want to apply this constitutional standard, but in Powell, they had this burden shifting that if the accused supposedly shows all of the first three parts of the analysis, that somehow the burden now shifts to the government to then prove or convince the appellate court that the forfeited error that has apparently shown material prejudice to substantial rights is harmless beyond reasonable doubt. I think that's kind of the standard announced in Powell. Do you recall that? That's okay, because it is. I'll just ask that you agree with me on that. All right. Now, if that's the case, getting back to your position, once you convince us that there's been an error, that it's been plain and obvious, how then do you envision our case law suggesting that you show us that there's been material prejudice to your client's substantial rights?
Your Honor.
In this case.
In this case, Your Honor, because the substantial right is, as Article 59 notes, the substantial rights, that's because the substantial rights in this case are constitutional, because as the Supreme Court noted in Chapman, because these rights touch on the U.S. on constitutional rights, there is material prejudice. You've overcome that hurdle.
And let's assume that you make that, you overcome that hurdle, as substantial as it might be. What do you then envision happens next? Do you envision what Judge Gerke and U.S. v. Powell envision, that once you show that, the government now has to show that it's harmless beyond reasonable doubt? The reason why I'm asking this question and kind of focused on this, or obsessed with it, some might say, is that the burden shift has never made much sense to me. In other words, if you and your client were to convince me that the forfeited error has materially prejudiced your substantial rights, it is not clear to me how the government comes back. And I'll ask them when they get up here, so you don't have to carry their water. All right. But you see what my problem is here.
Yeah, I do, Your Honor.
All right. Okay.
Can I ask you a slightly different but perhaps related question?
Yes,
ma'am. It seems to me that everyone agrees that the first, at least I think both sides agree, that the first two parts are that the error is plain, that it's plain and that it's obvious, right?
Yes.
That there's error and that it's plain and obvious error.
Yes,
ma'am. And both sides agree that there was plain and obvious Hill's error here.
Yes, ma'am.
Right? So it seems to me that the two of you part ways is when you talk about substantial prejudice to the substantial rights of the accused, and we all agree that that's what Article 59 requires.
Yes, ma'am.
So I think the question is, what does that mean in a constitutional, unpreserved constitutional error case versus an unpreserved non-constitutional error case?
We see no distinction, Your Honor. There is a
constitutional and non-constitutional.
Oh, no, constitutional and non-constitutional. I'm sorry, I thought it meant preserved versus unpreserved.
I think I would agree with you that how we treat an unpreserved non-constitutional error and a preserved constitutional error, that the test is the same whether the non-constitutional error is preserved or not preserved, correct?
For a non-constitutional, yes. Yes.
Right. And so, illogically, it would make sense that it would be the same for a constitutional error, whether it was preserved or not preserved. But I'm asking you your views on that particular point.
Just to make sure I'm clear on your question, just for a constitutional error, correct?
Yes.
Oh, preserved versus unpreserved.
Yes. Is there a difference in the test in your view? Other than if it's unpreserved, that they have to show that it's plain and obvious error.
That then, other than showing the having the burden of showing plain error, no, Your Honor. I think that's the entire point of Chapman, was to dispel the use of a statute or the employing of a statutory test to supplant what was established in Fahey versus Connecticut of harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. When we're dealing with constitutional rights, that just as this court did in Jones and Hoffman this past year, there is no initial Article 59 demonstration of substantial material prejudice to substantial rights, and then we do harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. There is no double.
Is it that whether it's harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, does that determine whether it's prejudice to a substantial right of the accused?
That's the question. That is the question that the Supreme Court demands that we ask to determine the Article 59 question. And that was exactly what was the issue.
Is it the appellant's burden to say, this prejudice my substantial right because of this error, you can't be convinced that I would have been found guilty?
Exactly, Your Honor. Exactly.
Which is different, I think, I hope you would agree, than saying that the government has to disprove that it's harmless beyond a reasonable doubt once you've raised it.
Yes, Your Honor. And that's the whole – and once we get to the third prong, once we successfully come over those first two hurdles, it should be plain and obvious that this materially prejudices our constitutional substantial rights.
Because we can't
be reasonably certain that this did not contribute to the verdict, using the precise language from Fahey, we can't be reasonably certain that the evidence complained of might have contributed to the verdict.
But it's your burden to show that.
Once we show the plain error, it should be apparent that we can't be confident of that. And that's apparent in this case. We cannot be reasonably certain that this did not contribute to the verdict.
Captain Turner, may I ask a question?
Yes, sir.
I understand your argument to be a constitutional argument, that this is based on the Chapman case and it's all constitutional. So is there any reason that our standard would be different from the standard that's applied by the federal circuit courts in similar situations? So if the case was decided in the First Circuit or Second Circuit, if you had an instructional error and there was no objection to it, so it's reviewed on plain error, is there anything in our rules or anything in the federal rules that would make those precedents, obviously they don't bind us, but that they would be not something we should rely on?
Just to make sure
Let me put it another way. If, for example, we found that the federal circuits were applying a different test, would there any reason that we should question whether we should have the same test as the federal circuits?
No, Your Honor. The Supreme Court in Chapman, as to quote them, they wanted to create a familiar standard for all courts. If a federal circuit
does not apply
to what the Supreme Court says, then that's we should not follow them off the cliff and follow them to the path of error or defying what is the clear intent of the Supreme Court. Yes, sir.
I was just going to say, is Article 59 and Federal Criminal Procedure 52 the same?
In terms of the precise language of material prejudice to substantial rights, no, not the precise language.
So, for example, the fourth prong of Alano, which I think is used for Federal Civil Procedure 52 analysis, is not something this court has ever utilized.
Right. The fourth prong is...
I was going to say that. It's because I pounded the table for several years trying to get us to follow Alano and gave up.
Yes, sir.
So
the fourth prong is almost non-existent in our jurisprudence.
Right, just because.
It was just... Yes, sir. However, just as the Supreme Court noted last year in Ortiz, we are a criminal court, so of record.
Right, but let me go back to your point about the Supreme Court establishing a plain error rule for all courts. You said that includes us, right?
Yes, sir. As noted in Ortiz, we are included.
Well, Alano was specifically directed at the interpretation of Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 52B, were they not?
Yes, sir.
And I know that Judge Ryan asked you about the difference between the two, but isn't there a difference in our rule in 52B? 52B says that the error must affect substantial rights, and our case law and our rule says that there must be material prejudice to substantial rights. You don't think that's a significant difference?
It is a difference between Article 52 and Article 59 in terms of the standards laid out in that language. However,
but then that goes back to my question then about, was the Supreme Court speaking to us and requiring us to adapt or adopt the analysis as it relates to our Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 52B? Because the language is very different, so how could they have been? They didn't mention our rule.
Sure. While a military court, I don't believe that we can resolve the difference or harmonize the Article 59 and Federal Rule 52.
I would agree there.
I think the important thing to note in this case that we can resolve is, do we apply the plain language of a statute for that third prong? Is that for constitutional error, preserved or unpreserved? And the answer is no. And that was what Chapman was all about. We asked this question of whether there was a reasonable possibility that this error contributed to the verdict. That effectively is the question we asked for in Article 50, to ask whether the material prejudice exists under Article 59.
And you already agreed, I think, with Judge Ryan's question that you have that burden, right? The appellant has that burden to show. If you have the burden to show the third element of the plain error analysis, and if the third element is that a showing must be made, that there is a reasonable probability that this forfeited error affected the outcome, you've got to show that, right? I mean, that's what you just told us.
Yes.
I'm not trying to get your wrath around the accident.
No, I'm just trying to make sure I keep it all. Yes, but yes.
And I will admit, it's confusing.
It's in terms of what question to ask for that third prong, it's not confusing. In terms of asking whether it is the plain question of whether material prejudice is substantial right is the actual question we ask. That's not the question. The question we ask is whether there's a reasonable possibility evidence complained of contributed to the verdict.
All right.
The whole reason why we're here is because the Army Court has a proposition that you have abandoned that question in favor of asking the literal question of Article 59 instead. That's why we're here. We're here because the Army Court believes that you have tactfully abandoned the standard established in Chapman for something else without telling anybody. And that's simply not the case.
I don't think they said that.
Well,
but we can get into that on rebuttal.
Yes, sir.
Counsel, can I ask, really getting down into the weeds for a second here,
yes,
is there any difference between the language you just articulated and the following language? Appellant must show a reasonable probability that, but for the error, the outcome of the proceedings would have been different. Is that language that you're endorsing?
No, that's different. That's different, Your Honor.
And how is it different?
Just as in Kreutzer 14 years ago, the subtle change in the standard of an outcome determinative test, it does raise the standard, and it does depart from Chapman because we have to ask whether there's – yes, ma'am.
I was going to say, isn't that latter test the one for non-constitutional?
Yes, Your Honor. In fact, like I said, in Kreutzer 14 years ago, a similar slight deviation from Chapman, from the harmless beyond a reasonable doubt question, resulted by the Army Court resulted in a reversal. Even though this, on its face, this is the quote you just or the question you just asked, Judge Olson, it's a slight change, but it's very substantial because it changes it from a question of did this contribute at all? To, well, the outcome is the same. That's a substantial difference, and it defies the guidance of the Supreme Court. As this court noted 14 years ago in Kreutzer. We ask you just to continue to apply the test that you've applied for the last 50 years, even as recently again as last year in Hoffman and in Jones. And essentially, again, our harmonization of this is if the substantial right is constitutional, then the prejudice is material unless it is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Pending any question, oh, sir.
Thank you, counsel.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Could I ask a question?
No, yes, sir.
I hate to keep beating you up.
No. I'm actually enjoying this. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, I'm not. But
I'm well.
In any event.
We'll get through it, sir.
The CCA has cited to this case called United States versus Robinson.
Yes, sir.
Authored by this court.
Yes, sir.
And in Robinson, there was an instructional error. And they say, of course, of constitutional magnitude, right? But they say that this court, and I've read it, and we have indeed, use the standard that we just alluded to. And the standard is this, that to establish plain error, the third prong is satisfied if the appellant shows a reasonable probability that but for the error claim, the outcome would have been different. Now, doesn't that add some confusion here to what we're all talking about? What standard do you use if it's constitutional error, and what standard do you use if it's non-constitutional error? You had agreed with Judge Ryan that that's usually the standard used for, I mean, this reasonable probability standard is the one used for a non-constitutional error.
That is correct, Your Honor.
But we used it in Robinson and suggested that was the standard we also used for constitutional error.
Yes, Your Honor.
You can tell us if we're
all over the place. I've read Robinson as well. To hear that from the court, if that is the court's position, then yes, it is.
I'm saying it's necessarily the court's position.
Counsel, you can address that in rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Counsel for the government.
Judge Stuckey, members of the court, may it please the court. I'm Captain Harris, and along with my co-counsel, Lieutenant Colonel Williams, we represent the government. The Army CCA applied an appropriate test for prejudice under this court's precedent in Williams and Guardado. An appellant has failed to prove prejudice. To quote the CCA, confusion does exist between what this court stated over a decade ago and what they wrote last term. The government can see how the CCA came upon the prejudice test it used, that is, a material prejudice to a substantial right of the accused. However, to the extent that this court disagrees, this case presents an opportunity to distinguish both the structure and the standard that should be used for Hill's errors.
Counsel?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Would you describe, or can you describe, the burden that's thrown on the government when this burden shifts, if it shifts?
Your Honor,
what does the government have to do if indeed there is one error, two error that is plain, and three error that contributed to the verdict? What's the government got to show? I suppose the government has to show that the error didn't contribute. Well, number one, the government to show that there's no error. But assuming arguendo there's error, and I think everybody agrees there's error. What's the government got to show, and how can the government show it?
In this case, Your Honor, our position is that the government wouldn't have to show it if it's unpreserved. So because of the appellant failed
it's to... It's waived?
No, Your Honor. In this case, and it seems this court's precedence treats Hill's errors as forfeit, so they do apply the plain error standard. But because appellant failed to preserve the issue at the trial level, then the plain error test would apply, which means that third prong of the plain error test, the burden relies on the appellant to prove the material prejudice to a substantial right.
Well, no, that's the other criterion. I used the first criterion. I used the criterion of affects the outcome. If the criterion is affects the outcome, or words to that effect, what's the burden that the government has to bear to reverse things?
In this case, Your Honor, the burden would not be on the government. The burden should be on the appellant because the appellant...
I'm assuming that the appellant has shown this.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so the appellant's shown this. Now, does the government have to do anything? Or is the government's position that the government can simply stand mute?
No, Your Honor, the government could show that the error did not contribute to the conviction.
Okay.
However, that sounds a little bit like Page, where there's that's the outlier case where there's sort of this burden shifting where there's three prongs and then only if appellant...
Why isn't prejudice to a material right of the accused that it is a plain error burden on the appellant to show that but for this, that we cannot be convinced that without this error, they wouldn't have been convicted, right? But for this error, we can't be convinced that they would have been, beyond a reasonable doubt, that they would have been convicted if it wasn't for this error.
In this case, Your Honor, it's because of the...
I realize that you're saying that Williams says one thing and that Hoffman says another thing, but they both very clearly say that the constitutional error was not harmless beyond reasonable doubt. And so you can find loose language perhaps in any opinion, but that's the standard.
Yes,
now
Your
the Honor. Question is, who has to show that, them or you?
The appellant would have to show that in the realm of unpreserved error, because it's the appellant's burden because he did not preserve it at the trial
What
level.
Does the appellant have to show?
The appellant would have to prove the third prong of the plain error test.
What does that mean?
In that he was materially prejudiced to a substantial right.
I know, but what does that mean?
We get that, Your Honor.
Because the test, if it's non-constitutional, what do they have to show?
A reasonable probability that but for the error claim, the proceeding would have been different.
And you'd agree that that's the exact same thing that they have to show if it's preserved error, preserved non-constitutional error.
No, Your Honor. If it's preserved error, then the standard would be an abuse of discretion. And at that point, because it was preserved, the burden would be on the government to show whether beyond a reasonable doubt the error did not contribute to the defendant conviction or sentence.
But it's still a reasonable probability.
Yes, Your Honor.
So that's the same.
The reasonable probability language is the same, Your Honor, but it matters. The government's position is that it matters whether or not it was preserved or unpreserved. So if it was preserved and the government does have the burden
Well,
to
it's prove, not preserved. It's never preserved or we wouldn't be here.
Well,
so,
Your Honor,
counsel, can you get back to my question, which is prong one, done. Prong two, done.
Yes, Your Honor.
Prong three, done. Now what happens?
In that case, Your Honor, it appears that the appellant would prevail because
okay.
the courts stay state, and I think it's
That's
in Page
refreshingly candid.
Yes, Your Honor. In Page, the dissent talks about it may be difficult once the appellant proves a material prejudice to a substantial
Right, problem. Which is the point it's Judge Sparks is making. It seems grossly counterintuitive to say that appellant, you show all this stuff. Now you have shown it, but the government may yet have its pound of flesh by showing something which seems virtually impossible to show.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is it an empty right that is given to the government?
Your Honor, I believe I understand the question, and that is where Page sort of came up with that quasi-fourth prong burden-shifting test. However, our position is that we adopt more the dissent of Page in that the Supreme Court has not spoken directly but suggested that the plain error test need not be changed to accommodate constitutional error. If the error is constitutional, yes, Your Honor, the standard remains the same. It just becomes easier for appellant to bear that burden. What our position is that the appellant must first establish the third prong of plain error. And it should be plain error because he failed to preserve. If we get rid of that third prong and we automatically shift the burden to the government right away once we get to the prejudice prong and make the government prove harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, then we are forcing the government to disprove something where the appellant failed to preserve it at
trial. Well, but that wasn't my question.
Counsel, I mean, I guess maybe we're not disagreeing about anything, but my question is this, is why isn't what the defense has to show prejudice to a substantial right in the realm of constitutional error, the ordinary test for constitutional error, as opposed to the lesser proof or the higher proof for them for non-constitutional error.
I'm sorry if I misunderstood, Your Honor, but I believe that's correct. So the appellant would, my point was the appellant would bear the burden and not that the government would have to disprove harmless beyond a reasonable
right,
doubt.
But they would just have to raise, their burden would be to show that this was not harmless, that this was not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt.
The appellant bearing the burden for that.
Yes.
Yes, Your Honor. And it appears that there is confusion, and that's what the CCA was feeling, this confliction. They attempted to harmonize the perceived discrepancies between this court's differing tests for the same type of error. And so what the CCA did was they focused on whether or not the error was preserved versus unpreserved, and that's where the CCA made the distinction. And the case law shows that there is some confusion relying on Williams and Guardado, because on both of those cases, this court analyzed it using plain error, but once we agree on prong one and prong two, but once we get to prong three of plain error, I think that's where we disagree. And the appellant would say the burden automatically shifts, changes to the government.
But that's not what they said today.
Your Honor, depending on the appellant's or his questions today, that's what was addressed in the brief. That's what they argued in the brief, was that the appellant would not have that burden. So to the extent that he agrees that the appellant does continue to bear the burden on prong three, then the government would agree with that position.
I have a question, if you guys don't mind, which is, and this is, so it seems to me fairly clear that even in the realm of unpreserved error, if it's constitutional nature, that this court has required a showing that the error was harmless beyond reasonable doubt. And there's been some equivocating as to who has to show that, but they've always had that standard. If, in fact, it's true that criminal courts of appeal in the civilian world have come to a different conclusion, what in your view, would be the reason for that?
Your Honor, I believe that the Article 59A, as referenced in Humphreys, there is some interplay with that and the federal rule 52, that it was patterned after the same thing, but as this court pointed out, they're not exactly the same. And so there is that interplay of Article 59, the harmless test, that the military uses and has adopted.
Is that because it's been more protective of the rights of service members? And if you don't know, I'm not asking you to speculate. I'm just wondering if your research has uncovered any reason for the distinction.
I don't know that, Your Honor. I believe under Humphreys, you know, there is the discussion against talking about the third prong of the military plain error test being derived from Article 59A. The federal plain error rule is similar, affects substantial rights, but again, they're not exactly the same, and I don't know why exactly that is. I do believe, though, that we have other precedent that, again, shows, even for constitutional error, that the burden remains with the appellant to first prove material prejudice to a substantial right. We see that in Oliver, that was a post-Hills case, rights that were constitutional in nature, but appellant failed to prove material prejudice to a substantial right.
Counsel, can I follow up on Judge Ryan's question? Is it the case that neither the rule in the federal circuit courts nor our rules says anything about harmlessness beyond a reasonable doubt? And the requirement of harmlessness beyond a reasonable doubt, if it exists, it must then therefore be a constitutional requirement. Is that correct?
Your Honor, I believe that the cases don't, that yes, shortly, in a short answer, sir, is they don't outright say harmless beyond a reasonable doubt.
And your position is that the Constitution does not require a showing that a unpreserved constitutional error is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Is that correct?
Could you repeat the question?
The position of the government is that the Constitution does not require a showing that an unpreserved constitutional error is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt.
I think it's hard to answer that, sir, without knowing which right it
is. Well, suppose it's not a structural right. It's an instructional error.
Yes, Your Honor. I think it still matters. It's still different. It's treated in different ways. For example, in Chapman, that was the standard where the court basically defined for us what the harmless beyond a reasonable doubt test is.
And that was a preserved error. But what about an unpreserved error? Does the Constitution require a showing that an unpreserved constitutional error that's not a structural error is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt?
Not in every case, Your Honor. For example, in ineffective assistance of counsel. So that's an example where the appellant could, let's say, for example, you have an attorney that failed to represent his client. We have a violation of the Sixth Amendment right to right to effective counsel. But in that sense, the Strickland test states that the appellant must also prove he was materially prejudiced to a substantial right based on that performance.
I think that might be a little bit different because you wouldn't expect ineffective assistance of counsel to be preserved.
Yes, Your Honor.
I'm talking about something like a instructional error. And so if we have an instructional error that is a constitutional error, not structural, but it's constitutional error.
Yes,
and it's unpreserved. Does the Constitution require proof that it's harmless beyond a reasonable doubt?
Following this court's precedent, specifically related to Hill's errors, Your Honor, no. It does not appear that that is the case. Following Williams, Guardado, also Humphreys, Oliver, Robinson. So these are different cases where, even in the realm of constitutional error, because it was unpreserved, it gets treated differently. And I hope that's answered.
And so if that's the case, then we wouldn't necessarily expect that the federal circuits would also would require harmlessness either, because their rule doesn't require it. And if they don't require it, they're not violating the Constitution.
I'm not familiar with how the federal courts treat it, Your Honor, so I don't know how to answer that fully. I'm sorry.
So, counsel?
Yes, Your Honor.
I'm pretty familiar with Humphreys, and I'm pretty sure that Humphreys required them to show that it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. I mean, that was the determination, that the error was not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Am I misremembering?
Your Honor, what I used Humphreys for was to show the plain error that in that there was no burden shift, so the government wasn't disproving harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. I used Humphreys for to stand for the proposition that there is a difference between constitutional preserved error versus constitutional unpreserved error. And so my use of Humphreys is to demonstrate again that there is a difference, or there should be a difference, between preserving an error at trial versus not preserving the error and still getting the benefit of receiving the harmless beyond a reasonable doubt test.
But the question in Humphreys was nonetheless whether the constitutional error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, correct?
Yes, Your Honor. And Humphreys talks about the standard we apply here is the constitutional error standard as articulated by this course in Powell. But Humphreys also referenced Article 59A and talked about the appellee in that case must show a material prejudice to a substantial right. So
the material prejudice was that it wasn't harmless beyond reasonable.
Yes, Your Honor.
Correct.
Yes, Your Honor.
I mean, they're not necessarily distinct things, is my point, which is that can be what the material prejudice is.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. I believe, if I'm following your question, I believe that that's the case. I think my focus was on the language. So my focus was on the language of material prejudice to a substantial right versus the government must disprove harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. So I think that was where I was trying to make the distinction. I hope that clarifies. And again, going back to Your Honor's question in Chapman, Chapman doesn't necessarily control here because, first of all, Chapman never talked about plain error. Chapman was only defining the test for harmless beyond a reasonable doubt once it already determined that it was in that realm. And furthermore, in the concurring opinion in Chapman, Justice Stewart noted, the differing values which constitutional rights represent may make the harmless error rule appropriate for one type of constitutional error, but not for another. And I think that's telling, especially reading the dissent in Page that again talks about if the error is constitutional, the standard is the same, the burden remains with the appellant, but it just becomes easier for appellant to meet his burden. Pending further questions, this court should affirm the findings and sentence because the appropriate prejudice was used by the CCA and appellant failed to prove prejudice under that standard.
Thank you, counsel. Does the appellant have rebuttal?
Your Honor, a point of clarity about unpreserved constitutional error in Chapman. As we briefed, Chapman, the error, as in Guardado, in Williams, and numerous Hills cases previously, the error did not exist at trial. The constitutional error was established during the pendency of appeal. There was no, as this court noted in Hoffman in summary reversal, you couldn't waive error that didn't exist at trial. The same is here and the same is in Chapman. There was, at the time of trial in Chapman, as in this case, the constitutional error did not exist. It was unsettled at the time of trial. So to create a distinction based on that fact, this court should not adopt that as a new standard. The Supreme Court made it clear in Chapman that when the error is not established at the time of trial, you do not lose the benefit of harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. You do not lose the constitutional standard established by the Supreme Court in favor of the non-constitutional standard. There is only one test, and that is established in Chapman, whether it is preserved or unpreserved instructional error, Your Honors. Pending any further questions from this court.
Yeah, let me ask you this. Is it your position, and I'm asking because I'm having a little difficulty understanding, is it your position that once you get to the third element of the plain error test and you have established what? That there's a reasonable probability that the outcome would have been different?
Yes. Once we've established that it was plain, mm-hmm. that it was obvious, at that point, Your Honor, as in Chapman, the there has to be a demonstration that this did not contribute to the verdict, that this did not contribute, Your Honor.
By the government. Yeah, but you're talking about by the government? I mean, we've introduced, and it's not your fault.
No.
But we've introduced this confusion by early on in our case law establishing this burden shift. Once the appellant has carried his or her burden to show plain error, there's this burden shift about the government having to show that it's harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, presumably for a constitutional forfeited error.
Yes, Your Honor.
So do you have any problem with that paradigm? I mean, or this whole burden shift at the end? It would seem that you would be satisfied or should be satisfied in saying, hey, look, once we show there's a reasonable probability that it would have affected the outcome, that should be the end of the story. That seems to me that should be your position.
Yes, that is the end. Yes, Your Honor.
And you shouldn't have the government coming in, this burden shifting, coming in trying to show that it did not contribute to the verdict by harmlessness beyond a reasonable doubt.
Correct, Your Honor.
I thought you would agree before that what you had to show was to show prejudice to a material right of the accused in a constitutional error case under plain error, that you have to show, right, that the error was not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, which is different than showing that there was no reasonable probability that it contributed to the verdict. And if you want a higher standard, that's fine.
Well, no. We would.
But we've always, at least for a while, and you can say we were wrong, but we've always used the language that it's not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt.
And we would continue to ask that that be applied, Your Honor.
But that it's your burden to show that. That's how you show material prejudice to your substantial right, which is
correct.
There was an error, it was plain and obvious, and it wasn't harmless beyond a reasonable
doubt. Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. I apologize for the.
Because there's a lot of language. Yeah, moving around, and some of it is somewhat similar, but it means very different things, as you recognize.
Yeah, and there's no need for you to apologize. I mean, it's our fault.
We can apologize. It's my fault. It's
you don't have to apologize. You certainly have to apologize to me.
All of us, I know.
And we love you. All right.
Yes, Your Honor. Pending any further questions from the court, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Court thanks counsel for both sides. Case is now submitted, and the court is in recess until 10:25.